This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. For the first 10 years of her life, from Halloween to Memorial Day, Gloria Steinem was a vagabond child, crisscrossing the country with her parents, their car pulling an Airstream trailer. She didn't go to school. Instead, she got her education from reading books and being on the road. Her dad bought, sold, and traded antiques, sometimes enlisting his daughter's help. As it turns out, she has spent much of her adult life traveling the world, this time in planes and taxis, buses and trains. Steinem writes about her new book, called My Life on the Road. And she says that travel for her is a form of meditation. It's also allowed her to meet a lot of extraordinary people, including two bikers at Sturgis, who it turns out were big fans of Ms. Magazine. Gloria Steinem is co-founder of Ms. Magazine, something she did in 1972. Before that, she was one of the founders of New York Magazine. She has written a number of books. She's received many awards. Back in 2013, she received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama. And Gloria Steinem joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
No, thank you so much. And as you were reading that, I was also remembering that the radio was our companion on those trips. So
Music
and talk, both. So thank you for bringing me home.
Absolutely. Well, I would love to, I know you've been asked this before, but I'd love to have you read the dedication to your book.
This book is dedicated to Dr. John Sharp of London, who in 1957, a decade before physicians in England could legally perform an abortion for any reason other than the health of the woman, took the considerable risk of referring for an abortion a 22-year-old American on her way to India. Knowing only that she had broken an engagement at home to seek an unknown fate, he said, "You must promise me two things. First, you will not tell anyone my name. Second, you will do what you want to do with your life." "Dear Dr. Sharp, I believe you, who knew the law was unjust, would not mind if I say this so long after your death. I've done the best I could with my life. This book is for you."
Did he know you became Gloria Steinem?
I doubt it, because he was probably as old as I am now, which is pretty old, or close, at that time. I doubt it very much, because it was literally a point at which I was going to live in India for 2 years. Then I came back and was a journalist. Even the civil rights movement was not yet a big public event, much less the women's movement, so I doubt it. But I just want to thank him and all of those physicians and nurses and, you know, who have risked their professions in order to say, wait a minute, you know, this is a fundamental human right to control our own selves.
Abortion is a very common procedure, as we know, from when it was illegal to the fact that it's legal now. But it seems that many women are reluctant to go or be as public as you have been about your abortion. Why do you think that is? Why do you think people don't tell these stories?
You know, the reputation, you might say, of women is so dependent on motherhood in a way that the reputation of men is not dependent on fatherhood. It's quite out of balance. So confessing, and also confessing to sexuality, to the fact that sexual feelings are with us all, and that is a way we reach out to each other and express caring and connection, in addition to a way we have children if we choose to. That has been so absent from women's lives that I think that in spite of all the progress we have made, women still feel guilty or vulnerable. Mm. In fact, in ancient original cultures, it was assumed that women controlled this process. And it was necessary that women controlled this process, because if women do it, then it's a health concern for women, and the population growth is not out of control, because we naturally, you know, don't want to perish. We control this process.
Do you think, though, and I've been thinking about this more recently in light of the fact that there's so much more support now for gay marriage, and in part one of the reasons for that is that people have either been outed or outed themselves, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, I have a gay uncle. Oh, I have a gay neighbor. I wonder if women were more outspoken about their abortions, whether that would mean there was a different view or attitude about abortion in this country.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. And in the very first issue of Ms. Magazine, we had a petition from 400 well-known women saying, I have had an abortion and I demand the decriminalization and so on of abortion. And that was patterned after something that women in France had done. So it was present and it still is present. There are books of abortion stories. There are television films, but not to the same degree. Mm-hmm. And without truth-telling, you really can't know what's going on, and you can't really have a movement. So I think we truly must do it. There are other differences. The primary important thing is telling the truth, because that's the basis of every movement. But it's also true that there is a difference in acceptability. That is, to want to be married or to want to be in the military is more acceptable than not wanting a child or not wanting to be in the military, if you see what I mean. So there are some differences of substance, and there are some differences of numbers in the population.
Do you think that abortion, the right to an abortion, is at risk? I mean, certainly it's going to be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. You look at many states, actually, and there are many rules and regulations that have been instituted in the last couple of years.
Yes, it is at risk, though the anti-abortion movement did not get what it wanted in Washington, which was a so-called right to life or pro-life, human life amendment to the Constitution. They did succeed in limiting very lethally the rights of poor women who are dependent on government-funded health care, of young women who are now in many states subject to the authority of their parents, even though if you're old enough to get pregnant, you're old enough to get unpregnant, and to women in the military who, despite all the understanding now of rape and sexual harassment in the military, still cannot have an abortion or even be guaranteed a leave to go and have an abortion on their own because of the Hyde Amendment, which has limited all federal funds. So they won that, but they didn't win the entire victory they wanted. Therefore, now the right wing has gone to state legislatures. Oh, yes, I forgot to say that in between those two things, yep, they also firebombed abortion clinics and murdered 8 abortion doctors and seemed surprised that that didn't make them popular. So now their tactic is to use state legislatures where they are much more likely to be in control, because those legislatures tend to be controlled by business interests, insurance, liquor, so on, that makes them way more conservative than the people they represent. And that is our fault, too, because most Americans don't know who our state legislators are. We have to pay attention to this. But now the movement has moved to the states, and the effort is to make it simply impossible, physically impossible, for abortion clinics to function.
What about the sort of conflation of birth control and abortion, and certain birth control methods are now seen mm-hmm. as a form of abortion?
Yeah, it's very important. Actually, the same groups are often against even sex education, much less forms of contraception. And a lot of this is racially motivated, I find. I mean, they will cheerfully say to you, the white race is committing suicide with abortion and contraception. And you will note that in most cases, the same groups are against immigration. I think we are at a peak of this in part because the country is about to become a majority non-European American or non-white country, which seems to me a good thing, you know, because we will understand the rest of the world better. But for people who got born into a culture that told them their identity was dependent on race, on class, on being a white male, whatever it is, They're very scared right now. And we are therefore in a period of maximum danger, even though they are nowhere near the majority of the country.
Are they more organized? I mean, is that part of the problem? And are you looking for, you know, people taking to the streets the way they did in the 60s,
Well, 70s? They are more organized. And they also tend to have more money, you know, because the Koch brothers and, you know, the conservative forces tend to be better financed. But we can defeat them democratically if we behave like a democracy. We have to understand that the voting booth is the one place on earth where the most powerful and the least powerful are equal. And we have to pay attention to our state legislatures and take them back.
And it's so interesting, and I don't want to make this totally a partisan issue, but when it comes to voting, Democrats, especially in things like primaries, where so much is decided these days, is that Democrats will stay home, or more likely to stay home than Republicans.
That's true, and we're responsible for that. It's also partly because the very right-wing religious groups are illegally using church buses and funds to bus people to the voting booth. And also state legislatures, again, are redistricting themselves into perpetuity, both in the state legislatures and in Congress. So it has become way more difficult to vote. I mean, we have always made it more difficult than any other democracy. It's becoming still more difficult. In the last two presidential campaigns, I've campaigned in Florida. And I, you know, you see in poor neighborhoods, in black neighborhoods, people waiting 4 hours, 5 hours to vote. You see that the state legislature has taken polling places away from universities. You know, it's so clear, you know, who they are trying to turn out and who they are trying to suppress. So we have to not only vote, we have to fight to vote.
Well, we're almost having a break here. I mean, do you see this as a losing battle for your side?
No, absolutely not. No, we have the numbers. We absolutely have the numbers. And we have to behave as if everything we do matters, including our votes, and then we'll win.
And that's Gloria Steinem, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, writer, lecturer, editor, feminist, activist, vagabond. And she's written a new book. It's about her life on the road. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. I actually want to get back to her life a little bit because she's had a fascinating childhood on the road with her parents, her sister as well. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, Gloria Steinem is our guest here in the Philadelphia studio, and she's got a new book. It's called My Life on the Road. It's in part about her life as a child growing up, basically in the back of her parents' car as they traveled the country. Also, we've been talking about her abortion, talking a bit about politics as well. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I really like the sections about your family and your growing up, in part because it was unusual. You had interesting, perhaps eccentric parents. But I always like to know where somebody came from, how that made them who they are. And I'd love to have you read a section from the book about your dad.
Oh, well, thank you for marking this section. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I remember my father driving on desert roads made of wired-together planks with only an occasional rattlesnake ranch or one-pump gas station to break the monotony. We stopped at ghost towns that had been emptied of every living soul and saw sand dunes pushing against lurching buildings, sometimes shifting to reveal a brass post office box or other treasure. I placed my hands on the weathered boards, trying to imagine the people they once had sheltered, while my parents followed the more reliable route of asking the locals. One town had died slowly after the first asphalt road was laid too far away. Another was emptied by fear when a series of mysterious murders were traced to the sheriff. A third was being repopulated as a stage set for a Western movie starring Gary Cooper, with sagging buildings soaked in kerosene to make an impressive fire, and signs placed everywhere to warn bystanders away. Ever challenged by rules, my father took us down the road to a slack place in the fence and sneaked us onto the set. Perhaps assuming that we had permission from higher-ups, the crew treated us with deference. I still have a photo that my father took of me, standing a few feet away from Gary Cooper, who is looking down at me with amusement, my head at about the height of his knee, my worried gaze fixed on the ground. As a child who wanted too much to fit in, I worried that we would be abandoned like those towns one day, or that my father's rule-breaking would bring down some nameless punishment. But now I wonder, without those ghost towns that live in my imagination longer than any inhabited place, would I have known that mystery leaves a space for us when certainty does not? And would I have dared to challenge rules later in life if my father had obeyed them?
I really love that section, and I have to say I was just very taken with your father as a, as you say, a rule breaker, a dreamer. I mean, someone who really followed his own, what, passions, interests?
Yes, and his own hopes. You know, very little that he attempted was a success, but, I mean, we were always living on the economic edge. He was always in debt. I learned as a child how to recognize debt collectors and go to the door and say, Daddy isn't home, and so on. Mm-hmm. But the dream was the important thing. The dream was what kept him going. And I value that in him. And I also am so grateful to him that he treated me like a friend. I was his companion, his playmate almost. He asked my opinion, even at a very tender age. He altogether treated me like a person, and that is so valuable in every way. It's also especially valuable for daughters of fathers, I think, because then you know that there are men in the world who do treat you like an equal, even as a child.
You have a great scene. It's just a paragraph where you're at your best friend's house and sitting around the dining room table, and they're not allowed to have their dessert until they finish their main course. You go home, and it's a different situation. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yes, I had never seen that before, and I was appalled.
That you had to eat your main course before your dessert.
Yes, I was shocked. So I went home, and my father and I were eating in the living room. We very rarely made it to the dining room table, and bringing things in from the kitchen. And so when I was ready for dessert, I tested him. You know, he asked me, do you want ice cream? And I said, but I haven't finished my main course. And he said, oh, but that's okay. Sometimes you're hungry for one thing and not another. I loved him so much at that moment. I so wish I had told him.
Oh, I mean, that's a regret that you have.
Yes, yeah, because I think it takes us a while to realize what is really, really lasting and valuable about our parents. And sometimes there's no time to say so.
But did you feel like maybe in hindsight that you had to be more grown up than you were? Here you had a dad who, you know, was a bit of a dreamer, as you said, maybe more like a friend perhaps than a father, a mother who had mental illness problems and seemed to require a lot of care and seemed like a hurt person in a way.
Yes, I think she was a hurt person. I'm not sure she had mental illness problems. After I wrote about her a long essay called Ruth's Song, because she could not sing it, and I was on a book tour like this, people would sometimes say to me, aren't you worried that her mental illness is inherited in some way? I was shocked. And I would say to them, only if patriarchy is inherited, because I think that what happened to her was her spirit was broken because She gave up everything she loved, which had come really before I was born, so it took me a while to realize that. She was a pioneering newspaper reporter. also, she'd come from a relatively poor family, so she was worried about money, and yet she married a man who was constantly in debt, which made it harder for a whole lot of reasons. And she fell in love with another man who was in the newspaper office and, you know, felt she could not give in to that. For a series of reasons, she had what was then called just a nervous breakdown and was in a sanatorium for a while. And by the time I knew her, she had given up everything she loved. And I think that's what broke her spirit. I mean, her spirit was still there sometimes, you know, especially in the poetry she loved, the books she loved. But she sometimes was just incapacitated by anxiety and just couldn't function. So I did become a grown-up prematurely, which I think many people experience. I mean, talking to the children of alcoholics, for instance, they've had a very similar experience. And it does mean you grow up too soon, but it has some advantages, too. I mean, you do understand that you can survive and be competent.
You wrote that she loved you but just couldn't take care of you. I mean, that was the situation that you and she were in.
Yes, yes. No, that's true. But she, too, was very loving. I mean, I was not in the situation of some children who are just subject to violence or criticism or neglect. You know, that was never true for me. It was very insecure and uncertain, and I was got my roles reversed with my mother. I was her mother. but I recognize and mourn how much worse it is for a lot of kids.
What's so interesting, and like a typical a kid growing up, you want what everyone else has, I mean, because you want to go to school, you want to have the home, but you have spent so much of your adult life on the road, sort of like your dad and your mom, I guess, as well.
Well, you know, it never dawned on me for a moment that kids might envy me. I was busily looking at kids in movies and seeing that they lived in nice houses and they had ponies and they walked to school with their friends. You know, I thought that's what I wanted. And it took me a while to realize the advantages of my own childhood.
And being on the road, which is so much of what your book is about, the kind of freedom that you feel, the people that you meet, the sense of not having a... You know, the sort of strictures of responsibilities, even of having a less itinerant life.
Well, I've come to feel, you know, especially while writing this book, that our normal, not exactly normal, but our most frequent way of life as the human species was migratory, because we were following the seasons, the animals, the crops. We were, however, living in a group at the time and gathering around campfires. I think the whole idea of settling down is new and cruel and really only comes from industrialization and people's dependence on jobs and salaries, that in our cells, in our memory, is the idea that we are migratory with other people. We need both the campfire and the migration. And part of this book is to tempt people into our own migrations on the road, to know the country better, to be more open to experience, to stop thinking about the American people as one homogenized lump. We are incredibly diverse. And I, you know, for years I've tried to learn meditation. I've taken several courses. I've listened to all my friends. I totally believe in it. Meditation
can you do it?
No. I can't. I just don't absorb it into my life. And I've finally come to the conclusion, which might be an excuse, we're not sure, that the road is my form of meditation because it forces you to live in the present.
That's Gloria Steinem, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. needs no introduction. I'll just say the name of her new book. It's called My Life on the Road. And we've been talking a bit about her life on the road now and certainly as a child growing up. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments I see from email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. I read that one of the titles you thought for this book was America as if Everyone Matters. And I get the sense that you feel as if maybe it's the media, I'm not sure, but people are overly critical of Americans, or perhaps, you know, make broad generalizations about them. And also that you are interested in stories, that stories are sort of the heart of what interests you.
I notice that people's attitude toward travel in this country is different, because when I say that I'm going to any place from Australia to Zambia, they say, oh, how great, that's so interesting. And when I say I'm traveling in this country, they say, oh, it must be so tiring. So this book is way more about travels in this country, well, including my early years of living in India, because that was important to sort of the foundation of traveling. But otherwise, it's in this country, because I hope and believe that people will understand it's worthy of traveling in. And I devoutly wish that all of our elected officials would have an obligatory 2 years of traveling, not, in a enclosed space, but actually talking to people. I think it would help our policy so much, because people on the ground who have a particular problem know the solution to it way better than somebody who's making policy in Washington.
I've been to Sturgis, so I know that rally, and I was so tickled when I read that story of these, you know, hefty-looking bikers, and next thing you know, two avid readers of Ms. Magazine, a husband and wife couple.
Well, you see, somehow I had managed to live without knowing that 250,000 bikers accumulate in Sturgis.
They do.
Which is so, you know, apparently you can, from outer space, you can see the grid of the highways. And, of course, there's the Black Hills and all kinds of. So I just happened to be going there with friends to a powwow, an important powwow, because it was celebrating the powerful and equal position of women in Indian country in the past before Europeans showed up, and trying to say, hello, you know, let's restore this. So we were all shocked to see all these bikers, and we were kind of scared of them.
But nonetheless, you found kindred spirits, right?
Yes, I was. It was a real lesson, a true, true lesson in not imposing your expectations on anybody. The first time it happened, we were in, just a small town, and the bikers were around. And I heard one male biker saying to his wife, shop as much as you want, honey. I'll meet you in the cappuccino place.
Well, that's exactly the picture you had in mind.
Right. But I thought, oh, no, that's an exception. And it wasn't until the end of the trip, when I was sitting in the motel dining room trying to be open-minded about the fact that I was surrounded by mostly guys in chains and knives and leather and tattoos and, you know, earrings, and when I could see that there was a couple next to me, a man and a woman, older man and woman, an older biker chick, I would say, by her hairdo and everything, who were aware of my presence. And finally, the woman came over to me and said how much she enjoyed reading Ms. Magazine, which was a total shock. And even that since her husband had retired, she got him to read some, she said. And then she said, isn't one of the women with you Alice Walker? I love her poetry so much. It was such a lesson to me. And the great thing that she did after that, before she left, was to tell me to look out the window at the parking lot and see her purple Harley, which meant a lot to her, because she finally had got her own Harley instead of riding on the back of her husband's Harley.
Women's liberation. Right,
right, exactly. And she was saying how her grandkids, you know, were just totally knocked out when grandma rode up on her purple Harley. We were also next door to the Badlands, and anybody who's ever seen those Badlands knows that they're a moonscape. You know, they're very monochrome and scary, and you can easily get lost. But once you're in them, you do indeed see all the different shades of rose and cream and all the grottos and so on, but only if you're in them. Anyway, so she was pointing out her Harley, after she left, I thought, this is really the lesson of this book in a lot of ways. Well, it took me longer to figure that out, but because anything from a distance is very different from anything close up.
Well, also, I was reading, I think it was in the New Yorker, sort of a mantra that you have, which is ask the turtle.
True. And it took me a long time to realize that that was important, too, because it happened when I was in my first year in college taking geology, because I thought it was the least scientific of the sciences I might be able to get through. We were looking at the Connecticut River with our professor, our whole class. I had, found a turtle that had crawled up the dirt path from the river and was embedded in the mud on the side of an asphalt highway. So I was paying no attention to the lecture that the professor was giving, but had wandered up this road and was sure that turtle was going to go up on the asphalt road and be crushed. So I picked it up, snapping, angry, dangerous turtle, actually, and finally got it down the road, put it in the river, and just as it was swimming away, the professor came up behind me and said, you know, that turtle has probably spent maybe a month crawling up that road to lay its eggs in the mud on the side of the asphalt road. So I felt terrible, obviously terrible, but it took me much longer to realize, and living in India and becoming and seeing real organization, to realize that the motto, always ask the turtle, was transferable to almost everything.
That's Gloria Steinem, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about her life. She's written a book called My Life on the Road. And I do want to get callers in and comments in as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Gloria Steinem, feminist writer, lecturer, vagabond. We've been talking a bit about her childhood on the road with her parents, also about her life as an adult, traveling the world for her work on activism and organizing. She has found the road is full of possibilities and, as it turns out, fascinating people to meet. And her new book is called My Life on the Road. Let me get Becky from, looks like Chinatown, to join us on Radio Times. Becky, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking questions.
You're welcome.
My name is Becky, and I'm a legal advocate for a domestic violence intervention organization in central Pennsylvania. But since starting my job in October, my hours have been cut to part-time due to the state budget crisis. Luckily, our shelter has remained open, but many aren't able to. And so I'm asking, what advice, Ms. Steinem, do you have for young feminists who want to do work they believe in, but who also want to practice self-care in a world that just doesn't value our work?
Mm-hmm. Oh, dear, Becky. And I should just add that we have a budget crisis in the state of Pennsylvania. The governor and the legislature have not come to an agreement, so there are programs that are going without funding, mm-hmm. just so you
well,
know.
Well, first, I want to thank you for your work. Nothing but nothing is more important. The entire measure of violence outside the home is violence inside the home, because that's where it gets normalized. And I thank you so much for your work, and I hope that we get to a place in society where we understand how fundamental your work is. I think there are two questions here. One is the budget and the other is self-care. I would say while we are fighting to get care and money for domestic violence, which is so fundamental, and if you do not stop it, it becomes way, way, way more expensive with all kinds of injury and death and generations of violence. Nothing could be more important. It's possible that we might have to revert to what we did in the beginning, which was offering places in people's homes, people who have an extra bedroom and who have some training and empathy to take in women and perhaps children too, but that does not mean we shouldn't reform the budget. Mm. As for self-care, I would say that most women need to reverse the golden rule. We need to say, I'm going to treat myself as well as I treat other people.
And you think women don't do that enough?
No. I think it's pretty rare because we are so trained to be nurturers and caretakers that we tend to take better care of other people, to listen to them more, to just pay more attention to their needs than we do to our own.
Becky, good luck, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Susan from Collingswood has to say. Susan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious what your thoughts are when you hear people say that our country has gotten too PC. And I'm curious if you could just give me your take on this.
Oh, fair enough. Thanks for the call to Radio Times.
You know, it's funny you say that because movements in general, invented politically correct in order to make fun of ourselves.
Ah.
That's where the term came from. And I do believe that freedom of speech is a great treasure, and we all have the right to it. So we have the right to object fiercely, but we don't have the right to silence. And if we can balance those two things together, earlier today I was thinking about examples I see on campus where if someone is speaking and saying things that are offensive, they don't keep the person from speaking. They turn their chairs around. I thought that was kind of brilliant.
So you listen, but you're not.
Well, you're not keeping them from speaking, but you're expressing how you feel.
What do you think about, they're called microaggressions, and there are some colleges, universities, where there might be a warning on a novel like The Great Gatsby, saying that, you know, contained within this novel are examples of violence and misogyny, for instance. Do you think that's a good thing?
Well, if it raises consciousness, which precedes change, it's probably a good thing. In the case you cite, it doesn't seem necessary, I mean, because it's clearly a period piece. It isn't as if it's in the present.
I guess the criticism is that, and this is, you know, broadly speaking, is that that women can't take it. That somehow that they need protections from literature or protections from controversial ideas.
I don't sense that that's the problem. It's not protections as much as it is consciousness, because bias against women may be so organic to the culture that you don't compare it, say, to anti-Semitism or even to racist literature, which we might, I hope, recognize more easily. So, you know, if those warnings make us conscious without withholding our experience of the past, then I don't see any harm in it. It's the censorship that's the problem.
Mm. Let me get Carol from Drexel Hill to join us on Radio Times. Carol, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Calling to say what an honor it is to have the opportunity to speak with you and to thank you and to hopefully, you know, add an oar in the water of letting you know what a difference your insights make. They're so simple and clear, and if only we could disseminate them further. And just in fact, for example, distinguishing mental illness from broken dreams or from patriarchy or from you know, not living your own life. And I wish people would keep digging when they come across, for example, diagnoses of that. And there's more going on, and you know, it's
sure.
Just, yeah. Anyway, mm-hmm. Thank you. And I wonder how more communication, more conversations could start. I mean, you certainly start them, but you wonder how more people, we can find more like-minded people such as yourself. Mm-hmm. And thank you.
Well, thanks, Carol, for calling into Radio Times.
Well, I think we can all start these conversations with each other, and these kinds of truth-tellings and personal experiences and, you know, you have to tell the truth to discover you're not alone, which probably you are not. And I agree about the diagnosis of mental illness, because frequently in the past, as in a pioneering book called Women and Madness, which is, you know, we should go back to, you see that mental illness is the description of someone who isn't following their gender role. And there is still mm-hmm. some of that, and we need to be thoughtful about that and not label or stigmatize.
I was interested in your book reading about Betty Friedan, and it sounded like Betty Friedan had some arguments with you, with Bella Abzug and others, seeing the feminist movement very differently. And you had some pretty pointed critiques of her.
Mm. Well, I can kind of understand. I mean, if you've had you haven't been credited in your life with what you deserve to be credited for, and you feel that you have founded a movement, then other people who come, of course, by definition, a movement is many people. So if others come along, like Bella Abzug or me or Shirley Chisholm, and are regarded as co-founders, you might say, or at least initiators in some way, it feels bad. You know, you finally have something of your own, and suddenly it's not your own.
You have to share it.
Yeah, and I think that was hard for Betty. And so, you know, she mostly, you know, people say they assume that we really knew each other. We mostly didn't know each other because, you know, she wouldn't talk to me sometimes when she saw me.
She didn't shake her mother's hand.
Right. So there it is. You know, it just happens. And it's a product of damage.
Well, it also sounds like, and there is a critique, right or wrong, that the women's movement is a movement of, you know, middle-class white women. Your argument is that that's not true at all, although it sounds like Betty Friedan wanted to hold on to that. She didn't like the inclusion of people on welfare, so to speak, or lesbians, for instance.
You know, the book that she wrote is a very important book because it addressed women, white women with college educations living in the suburbs saying, wait a minute, you know, there must be more to life than this. I would say it was reformist in a very important way, more than feminist, because it wasn't addressing women as a group. So it was probably a surprise to her that other women were showing up and saying, wait a minute, you know, this is about women as a group. Her book didn't speak to me. It was actually the women who were in the civil rights movement or the anti-Vietnam War movement who loved those movements, as we all did, but also found themselves in a secondary position inside them. And they came along a little bit later and founded a more universal, I would say, part of the feminist movement.
It's interesting, and perhaps this is more with younger people, but especially younger women, is that they haven't embraced the word feminism. Equality, yes, all of that. But the word feminism seems to have some baggage.
It does have baggage, but actually younger women are way more likely to use it than older women, statistically speaking. And, of course, there are other words that are great, too. There's women's liberation. There's mujerista. There's womanist. You know, we don't all have to use the same word. But the word feminist has been very consciously demonized in a lot of ways. And the radio world.
Feminazi.
Yeah, feminazi. Yes, right. So I think there are two problems with the word. One is that people don't know what it means. And if they go to the dictionary and see that it's someone, male or female, who believes in the full social, economic, political equality of males and females, they'll say, yeah, you know, okay, that's good. But the second problem is they do know what it means and they're against it. So that's real, too.
Let me get Vernice from West Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Vernice. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Ms. Steinem. I want to say that as a woman of color and a First Nations mixed race person, what you had to say about the feminist world and its roles is very poignant to me. When we started our West Coast, I'm a triplet, my twin brother and I, we started our West and East Coast pinging back and forth just because of life. And only in the last year, and I'm in my 60s now, have I had the opportunity to travel abroad. But your comments about the wonderful tapestry that most people are missing about this life and this world that we live in right here under our noses, our next door neighbors who are Sikhs or Sufis, our friends that live in Virginia and you've never seen the hills and the valleys or the Rocky Mountain West or snow in July. It's it's something that people don't recognize that about this country.
They you know, Vernice, yeah, let me just jump in here, only because you use a great word, the word tapestry. I mean, the country is a kind of a tapestry. Certainly when you fly over it, I mean, it looks like a quilt of some sort. Do you want to speak to that, Gloria Steinem?
Well, especially I was thinking, you know, listening to this caller, how grateful I am to the especially African-American women who taught me feminism. I, you know, in my experience, I recognize that people have different experiences, but in my life, it was way disproportionately women of color in general, but especially African-American women, who were way ahead of me in understanding that these caste systems of sex and race are all bananas, you know, that we are unique individuals, we're all human beings. I mean, they were just so far ahead of me in questioning the power structures. And, you know, I wish that were more visible. When I began to go out and speak because I couldn't get published what I wanted to get published, I was somewhat accidentally in the beginning speaking with a friend, an African-American friend, and then we discovered how important it was to do that together. So after she stayed home with her baby, then I, you know, had three other partners who were also African-American. And I really learned from them how important it is that we see sex and race as intertwined, and you know, you can't uproot one without the other. If you're going to maintain any kind of racism, you have to maintain racial difference. That means controlling reproduction, which means controlling women. So we just have to understand that these are intertwined, and you can't possibly be a feminist without being anti-racist, and you can't possibly be successfully anti-racist without also being a feminist.
Do you like being in your 80s?
I'm shocked, actually.
Are you? That you are in your 80s?
Yes. I tell people in the street my age, you know, I'm trying to convince myself.
Like, how did this happen?
How did this happen?
How did I get to be, what, 81?
Yes, 81. You know, it feels like someone else's age. But
do you like it, though?
Well, I do like it, but it is about mortality. I mean, I loved 60 because that was kind of the introduction to a free country that was somewhat beyond gender. So, you know, it had a freedom. But this, of course, is about mortality. So I am striving to realize how old I am, because if you think you're immortal, you don't plan very well. So I'm still working on this. But, you know, I think we're all, you know, those Russian dolls that are nested.
Yes.
So I think we're all like that. Our child self is still there, our adolescent self, our 20s and so on. And we just keep adding.
You do have a nest, though, now, right?
I do have a nest. I have a home that I love and that has things in it from friends and travel, and that means a lot to me. And I have recognized, after being excessively on the road for a long time, that I need the balance of this nest, that even birds have nests.
True. Well, Gloria Steinem, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And her book is called My Life on the Road. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. In fact, we have posted or are posting photographs of our guest on our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.